You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, Heritage Radio Network podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by 818 Tequila. Delicious and smooth tequila, meaning harmony with the earth. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Bento Box, a full-service marketing and commerce platform that helps restaurants get discovered, make more money, and engage their diners. Join over 8,000 restaurants already using Bento Box today to deliver better hospitality. Visit getbento.com/chef today to get your first month free. That's getbento.com/chef.
This is part two of my interview with Tim and Carissa Mondavi. We'll talk about their winery Continuum. They'll answer our wine list and we'll taste the Continuum for our weekly wine sip. Enjoy. I want to talk about Continuum. All right.
We need to do that
because at some point I got to get you out of here. So it's an estate winery, you know, where you own the land and you grow the grapes. But I'm interested in this because after years of doing this show, I've kind of moved towards this interest. You know, yesterday, Edward Chadwick talked about Sena kind of becoming organic, biodynamic. Yes. And that's important to me. I want you to tell me about farming practices.
Sure.
It took me a while to kind of figure out what it was, but when I found out, you know, I was very happy. But tell me, we talked about wine grower being important. We talked about the grape in the field being important. Tell me about your practices out there.
Okay, well, first of all, I'll tell you about our setting, because our setting, it affects our practices. Continuum is Oakville with altitude.
Okay.
Attitude
so
also.
Incredible.
We are just above
parcel with a little.
We are just above our old digs at Robert Mondavi Winery and Opus One on the east side of the valley. We have west. We have all the classics. You know, fabulous. It's westerly exposure, southerly exposure. There's complexity in some of the exposures. The altitude is from 1,300 to 1,600 feet.
It's great altitude.
It is absolutely right in there. And Napa Valley is only 4% of the wines of California, but the hillsides are maybe 4% of the wines of Napa Valley. They are nestled into the Garrigue. They're nestled into the vegetation.
So you're saying the hillside is 4% of the 4% of what Napa is?
That's right.
Okay.
Okay, so it's very tiny. It's very tiny. All the hillsides were abandoned after Prohibition. But anyway, we've come back to this area because we believe that there is great potential in sites that cause the vines to struggle. So Napa Valley, So the land that we have is volcanic in nature. The Mayacamas Range is more marine derived, okay, because of geologic issues. And I could talk also about that. But the Vaca Range, where Pritchard Hill is, where we are, is on volcanic soil, which is low in fertility, high in minerality. And so the vines
good are... drainage.
Very good drainage, and the shrubbery that envelops our vineyard are scrub oak, manzanita, California bay laurel, and it's biodynamically diverse. It has a tremendous heterogeneity, but it is all witness of this lower fertility soil. You look across the valley to the Mayacamas Range, which is more marine-derived with volcanic outcroppings, but it's more marine-derived, which is intrinsically more fertile. So the vegetation is greater. There's redwoods, there's pine trees, there's all this huge vegetation. And also what we see is the afternoon shade. But what we are on the afternoon sun side, morning sun as well as afternoon sun. So all of these things set us up for success. Our south facing is open to the San Francisco Bay. You can feel that fog coming off of the Pacific Ocean.
Wow.
You know, you can hear Mark Twain saying that the coldest winter he ever spent was a summer in San Francisco. And with that, you can feel not only the sparse soil conditions, but also the cooling breezes off of the San Francisco Bay that come in the afternoon. Both of them give the minerality and the nerve that our wines, that I think great wines have, that need to have to be truly great. So I was very lucky to find this site. But there is a biodiverse ecosystem within what we have. Also, we manage our vineyards ourselves. Everybody in the vineyards, I've been fortunate to have people that I have worked with for 35 years, 40 years.
You continue. Have people retiring on you. They've been around so long,
Cindy just, a couple.
Recruits from back from Robert
McGuire. Yeah,
right. Cindy Nagy. People that you trust and know
absolutely.
For so long.
Opus One. Opus One was Stu Harrison. Stu Harrison is a great guy. Philippe Cotin said that we need to protect Opus and protect this baby. We need it to stand on its own. We need advocates that will look out for Opus. And that means when you get in the marketplace, we need to fend off all the pulls by Mouton Cadet or Woodbridge. It has to find its own place. And so Stu was the Opus One. And so after he left there and had some externships, I asked him to come back to help lead our path for Continuum into the marketplace. And he and Carissa and I helped identify who would be like-minded, because Continuum is so tiny, and it's a baby. It needs to be protected, and so we had to.
Still.
It still does.
So, not as an outsider, but compared to Mondavi, it's tiny. I mean, it's a beautiful piece of property. It's not a tiny piece of property. Your output doesn't match. Some of the other stuff.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we're not talking like 12, 14 backyard acres. I mean,
we're talking
about a beautiful flat piece of property at the top of
it's flat and hill.
I retract the word flat.
Yeah.
But you do meadow out at some point.
Well, we have gentle slopes.
Right.
We have even slopes. If you evaluate what makes Grand Cru, there is a slope that is even, that is where you can do the balancing act of balancing the vine to the site, the fruit to the vine, all of that, the winemaking to the fruit, because there is an evenness of aspect. And so we've got 173 acres of land, 71 are dedicated to vines, 44 blocks. Continuum is planted 55% to Cabernet Sauvignon, 30% to Cabernet Franc, 10% Petit Verdot, 5% Merlot. It is evolving.
I was surprised to see that.
More Cabernet Franc.
I was surprised to see that you had, the five Bordeaux blending varietals, fairly well represented.
Well,
there are only
four. We don't have
There's no Malbec.
I didn't care for Malbec.
No, I know.
Nor Carmenere for
here.
It took me
a little time to find the Merlot plot.
Well, it's a small amount.
Yeah.
Because, again, it's a holdover from my recognition from the valley floor. The valley floor is not kind to Merlot.
No.
And we had, after we
So you wouldn't use valley floor
after
Merlot.
After we acquired Ornellaia, I wanted to have the continuity of terroir there, the site, but also guidance. Michel Roland, by that time, had succeeded Andrei Chelichev, who was the founding enologist for Lodovico Antonori. But I wanted to have Michel Roland carry on, and so I invited him to come to California and to work with us there and to work on Merlot, because we needed it. I still didn't, even after working, I came to the same conclusion, coincidentally, that Christian Moex, who is Mr. Merlot.
Petrus.
Petrus. He made Petrus happen. He is making.
But did you say yesterday that he took Merlot out of Dominus?
Yes.
It's crazy, right?
Well, it's not crazy. He is smart.
I mean, for the right reasons.
It's but for all the right
when
reasons.
When you think about
it. So
you
know. Mr. Merlot, well, Michel Roland, you know, but Christian Moex, the guy that actually makes the decision to put it in the bottle, couldn't do it with Merlot there. And and I felt the same way. The first three vintages of Continuum are based in Tokalon, no Merlot. Cabernet Sauvignon, it was about 53% Cabernet Sauvignon, 30% Cabernet Franc, 23% Petit Verdot, surprisingly enough. And so, and that was roughly the base blend for Continuum because I wanted it to be different than the wines I had worked on before. Robert Mondavi Reserve, Opus One, they all are far more Medoc varietal mix. 85% Cabernet Sauvignon, 5-10% Cabernet Franc Merlot. And then now, more recently, a little bit of Petit Verdot and Malbec. But at Continuum, four varietals that do best there. And
That's what it's about. It's not...
We have been doing this long enough to trust our own palates and to not follow what the classification of 1855 was successful in because they were the best, but to be guided by our own history. And now after 100 years as a family and after my own nearly 50 years being responsible for the wines for my family, we've done this a time or two.
So, but you had asked about farming practices.
Yeah, I was just going to come back to that. So, how do you portray it? Do you portray it as sustainable, organic? I mean, are you touching biodynamics? Are you adding stuff in there? I mean, everyone's using sulfur unless you're like a Loire Valley, no sulfur.
I think the whole point of the whole nature of being an estate-based winery and having a dedicated estate team is just continuing to gain your attunement to the nuances of your site from year to year. And so our vineyard team is involved in the tastings. And after vinification of those 44 blocks, we have 60, 70 different wine lots. And every year we've been working to tie back what's happening in the vineyards to how the wines are showing and how we can be improving things. And so from the beginning, we farmed the way we knew how to farm, which is organic. That's something that we feel passionate about. This site, we're in the nature of reflecting this gorgeous land. And we want it to be healthy for the land, for our team, for everyone enjoying it. But, you know, there's different interesting buzzwords that come up at every few decades, like regenerative farming, biodynamic, permaculture, all these things.
Biodiversity.
Biodiversity, which we have because we're, like as Dad was saying, we're nested in the native vegetation that belongs to that land. But so this notion of like permaculture where you're working within the footprint of your land and everything you're doing is, and if you can't do that, then use organic techniques. And I think so much of what we are doing is what you would call regenerative farming practices because it is about soil health and everything that we're doing is about maintaining that.
Well, you
have
to live with this for the rest of, you know, your winemaking dreams.
Right.
Yes.
So you want to regenerate the soil.
Right.
You don't
right.
want, like, so, just as a sidebar, Tokalon is now under, I think, Andy Beckstuff or whatever, under different ownership. Do they continue those practices?
I can't speak to other people's practices.
Yeah, I don't
practices.
Care. I'm just curious. You know, maybe, well, maybe not.
No, Andy owns, I believe, 89 acres of Tokalon.
80 acres.
And Robert Mondavi Winery owns, I think,
563
so we acres don't care or some such thing.
So totally different parcels within Tokalon.
So move me into another thing. One of the things that you talked about, and it was in a good way, was how important science was to the Robert Mondavi Winery, Mondavi University.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, sometimes science could be chemicals, additives, acids, all of that. So let's move from the vineyards into the cellar. Mm-hmm. Now, how are we making wines? I mean, are we manipulating? Are we letting the...
Well, I'd like to go also spend a little bit more time in the vineyards because the soil is fundamental. The soil is fundamental. It is filled with microbes. It is. We want that that microbial life in the soil.
Protecting the microbiome.
But the guidelines we have are health of the people that work with us, ourselves, health of our consumers, health of the water that is there, health of the soil. And fundamentally, we have to do that. All of these buzzwords that come along, one decade, another, fundamentally, those things have to be undergirded by what is healthy for the water, for the soil, for the people working and consuming our wine. That guides us beyond anything else. And so...
So biodynamics uses, you have livestock on your site that you then use right.
The old ram's horn.
Where we are, there's mountain lions, bears, wild boar.
There's a natural...
That's not a natural situation for keeping a cow or a goat. Like for without right. protection, you're basically setting them out as sitting prey. And so it doesn't make sense for
there.
Our site.
We've had
but
goats.
With herders there, and we've lost and,
yeah,
we lost
exactly.
A goat.
I know.
So the it's circumstance not, that's not can appropriate
dictate,
for our site.
Right, what's realistic.
Yeah.
Not even
Absolutely.
Appropriate, what's realistic.
Absolutely. But are we using some other biodynamic techniques? Absolutely. There's such an... That's what biodynamics is about, attuning to your site. And that's so we are doing that, attuning to the cycle of the moon, knowing that the sap flow is different with the cycle of the moon. All these things are absolutely ways that we are incorporating into our farming.
But fundamentally, we are trying to go... Well, we did a video back at Robert Mondavi in the 70s or 80s. We wanted to go beyond organic. We wanted to go beyond the restrictions that people had, because some of them would cause more of a scarring of the earth than and less effectiveness. So we were trying to go beyond that to ultimately understand what is the impact on the water, what is the impact on the land, what is the impact on the microbes within the soil itself, and ultimately what is healthy for us.
Doesn't Napa Valley kind of suck at that? As a general place, as far as organics, biodynamics, addressing, you're the one who specified water, which is hugely important. I mean, isn't it just a matter of beautiful rows and treatment and yielding?
No. I think it used to be that way.
It's better?
Well, it's
That's
way
all
better.
I want to
no,
hear.
No, it is better.
Okay.
It is better. And well, I've got stories about that too. But no, but we
You
are,
don't have time.
We wish everybody was using organic practices. There are certain, we've been herbicide free since we began Continuum and pesticide free. And there are places where those are still used throughout the valley, and it's just a shame.
I think you'll find that the people that are aspiring to the best are being as good to their vines, as good to their soil,
yes,
and their people as they
always.
Possibly can. But it is also
is
true.
Is that a generational thing?
Well,
we move, as Carissa becomes more prominent, is that more important?
Well, yes, it
I
is.
Mean,
more
that's
important.
A good thing, right?
Of course it is. Of course it is. It is a wise thing. We do need to use science to understand how can we be kinder to the soil and the water and the microbes of the land and to the health of the people, because this is fine wine demands patience. So the people that are really pursuing the best of wines are embracing their most natural of techniques to produce the best of wines. It is the corporations that are now more a part of life throughout America that are putting quarterly profits ahead of other things and cause people to
right.
increasingly forget about the long term. So there is no way in hell we could be doing what we're doing today without the history that we have and having the financial resources to be able to support our dream, literally our dream, which is to produce something that not only smells great and tastes great, but it's got to be good for you, and it's got to be good for the land.
Right.
So you asked about the cellar and our practices in the cellar, and I think that wine at the highest level is a natural process, and dad had the benefit of working with so many different varietals, and so going to different regions of the world where so many people maybe just focus on Riesling or just Pinot Noir or just Chardonnay or just Bordeaux varietals. And Dad, in the experiments and in what we were doing at Robert Mondavi Winery, he has this now very broad palette to draw from. And so as he was touching on earlier with Pinot Noir, the things that Pinot Noir demands, Cabernet loves. And so we do a lot with lees. We kick up the lees, keep it alive and suspended during the time in tank for fermentation. And then after we press it off, we're unfined and after we put it into barrels, we're unfined and unfiltered, and we keep it on the lees. We rack sparingly, maybe once or twice in the wine's life. And the only means of settling the wine is really to keep it still in a very cool cellar. But we believe that not fining and not filtering means you have more life and richness and energy and it comes through in the wine. And
yeah, our vinification is fairly classically Bordelaise. We have no stainless steel tanks, ironically, since my father introduced stainless steel tanks.
It's been half a show talking about that.
And it is ironic, but it is a testimony to us having the opportunity to pursue our dreams in the best of way and to set ourselves up for success.
And the advancement it of means, awareness and
it means
know-how.
Cleanliness, building in cleanliness, the ability to have an environment that is cool, that is microbe, we're not spreading out.
Meticulous.
Right.
Meticulous.
And we have the
maintained.
Proper temperature, the proper humidity for our oak fermenters. We have concrete fermenters that are somewhat indestructible, but you have to make sure that they are absolutely right for the vinification and clean. And our barrel room is quite cool, and because that's what we want to have to make sure that the microbiology is favorable to the wine and not just random. But cleanliness, good cleanliness is fundamental in the vineyard as well as in the cellar. So you want biodiverse elements in the vineyard. And you want natural, to set ourselves up for natural health
right.
in the cellar. So that's where our wines are natural. Every time you find, you take something out. Sometimes you take what you're looking for out, and sometimes you take other things out too. The same is true of filtration.
Filtering, right.
So we want to raise the wines properly, not to sculpt them down, to make them less than what they are, but to create an environment where they can naturally shine and they can grow into their own best expression.
So when we got to wrap the show up, not right this second, because we have to do the wine list, we have to do the weekly wine sip. You've been doing this longer than anyone, so I'm curious to your response on this question, because it's more than a buzzword, it's a reality. Has climate change changed the way you grow and make wine? I mean, do you have to harvest earlier? I mean, has Napa been affected by that? Because, you see in Champagne and Italy, they got all these fires. They're trying to heat the vineyards.
The
and then
protection.
The fires in California are like a reality now.
Yeah,
but let's just keep it in that sort of mini thing of the Mondavi family.
What are we
and
doing?
Continuum and how it affects.
Well, it's first of all, climate change is absolutely real. And if you are a farmer, you get whacked. And I could go through the 15, 16, and 17 vintages, 15 and 16 ill-timed. I used to think of global warming as ill-timed rain, either not enough or
right.
too much at the wrong time.
A little more involved than that.
But I'm not so worried about that so much. But in the hillsides, frost in the spring at Budbreaker, not that big a deal. We do get nipped every now and again. We did a little, ever so little this year. But that's not as big a deal. What has been a problem for us is the drought that has caused the vines to awaken early in early spring and then flower closer to winter in early spring, and Mother Nature is saying, oops, I've been too good to you guys, throws a blast of cold air.
That's a common.
And we had half a crop for Continuum in the 2015 vintage. The Valley Floor lost 35% of the crop because of that that cold snap during flowering. Okay, then the following year, the Valley Floor was back to normal, but 16, we lost 20% of our crop. Because of the bud differentiation that took place the prior year wasn't effective. So, and then 17, we had a perfect crop. Oh my God, it was beautiful. We harvested 2/3 of everything was in. We were on the last 4 days of harvest on Sunday night, October 8th. The following morning, we were going to start the last 4 days for the last third. And I have never seen wind like we had.
Oh, really?
That. So yet another way for Mother Nature to express her anger at us.
Well, and you know, growing up, those winds were always cool. In autumn, were always these cooling, wet winds.
These were hot winds?
The northerly winds that we get now are very drying. And so they're very, very...
Well, there's also just the power of the wind. I've never seen winds up to 50, 60, 70 miles an hour. And so these winds toppled trees into power lines and ignited fires.
Really
there were 17 fires throughout Napa and Sonoma started
the wind
with
stoked
that wind.
All the fires?
Absolutely. Well, it caused the trees to snap
down
the power
lines
that ignited the fire. So that is a major problem. And so in 17, we lost a third of the crop due to smoke. Because of the fires. In 20, we will not have a drop of continuum. We had two fires, one mid-August.
What do you mean we will not have a drop?
Meaning we harvested through the smoke because I wanted
on the 5th, 6th day of the fire, we brought in the remaining fruit that was going to take 4 days. We brought it in half the time.
Well, you're talking about the 2017
vintage. I thought that's
vintage.
Well,
I'm saying in 2017, we didn't use any of the fruit that was left out after that October 8th date that was exposed to the fire.
Well,
that was
you 17. Mentioned 2020.
But 2020 was even more severe because we had fires then because the droughts are longer, the area is dried out more. Lightning strikes happen.
In August, which was very early.
In mid-August. And so everybody was affected by that. There was another fire, a separate fire, that happened mid-September. But we were very close to that. So we harvested. Some people chose not to harvest at all. But I said, to your point, this is a new way of life. We have to learn to coexist with climate change.
And 95% of our effort had been put in. It's in the vineyards. So just...
Right.
Yeah, this is we are in a state entity. We're in a state entity. Everything we produce is we grow from our own land. So when 95, as Carissa's saying, most of the investment is already there. We already have all the people on board, and we have a team. So we have to learn how to coexist with global warming. And the worst of it is fire for us where we are. And so
well, that area, fire is as prominent a problem.
It's horrific, absolutely horrific. So the good thing that has come about is a realization that we as a community need to do a lot of work. During that time, our neighbors that own the land above us, the Chapelets, cleared a small road into a huge fire break. And so we are help supporting establish that fire break. We are clearing it every year as a community. We are clearing the understory of the garrigue of the chaparral that we have, which is what ignites first from a lightning strike. It is also what then is the tinder that causes the larger trees later to ignite. So we're clearing as much of that as we can.
We have to be more conscious.
The vintners.
Well, thank God your neighbor. The Chapelets.
Yeah, they have done a fabulous job with that. And
I would think up on
Pritchard
Hill, everyone kind of gets it.
Most do.
I was going to say, it's not. You would think it's more evolved, but don't give people too much credit.
That's right. But overall, though, I think that we are far more fire-wise now as a community. And we're able
you
to
You have
do
to be.
We have to be.
You have to be. So the way you conduct your business because of climate change has pivoted and morphed to a different way.
Well, we have been on this long curve towards harvesting a little bit earlier for the wine itself, for just the personality of the wine itself.
Not
this has
to beat anything else, just the style that you
the
want.
The style
you're
looking for.
Yeah.
Because when we first went up to this site, the tannins were quite powerful. And so I purposefully harvested a little bit later to allow the tannins to soften. As we are understanding each of the individual blocks better, we are understanding some of the elements that contribute to that, and we're managing around that, both in the vineyard as well as then in the cellar. And so we're vinifying differently. But that is we would do that with or without that. But it is also in allowing us to then harvest a little bit earlier as we always intended to.
Right.
And I have a little angel on my shoulder saying, Dad, let's bring these in a little bit earlier. Yeah. So,
thank God.
But at any rate, I think that the 19, getting around to the 2019, it is the finest expression.
So hold that thought.
Okay.
Because when we do the wine sip, which we're going to take the – we're going to taste the wine. We're going to talk about, we're going to get into what you were saying. But before we do that, I have this thing called the wine sip. I ask all my guests 5 questions, 250 shows, the same 5 questions, the greatest data bank of wine recommendations. So what I want to do is, because we don't have a lot of time, I'm going to ask you 5 questions. I don't want you to dwell on them. I want you to just think what the answer is, throw it out. I'm going to move to the next one. I'm going to go to Tim first and then you, Carissa. All right. So the first question, and I post these on our social media and I have a database of everyone. All right. And I didn't cut you off about the wine because when we're done with this, we're going to talk about it. All right, the first question is, what are you drinking now? What's in your fridge? What are you tasting? What's different? Are the seasons changing? What are you trying? What are you curious about? Give me a few things.
Okay, I love crisp white wines, fresh. Yesterday we had a Gruner Veltliner, which I thought was absolutely terrific for a summer afternoon.
So you're drinking seasonal wines now?
Seasonal wines, as well as crisp Chardonnays. I love Chablis.
Do you have any makers you love?
I have to give a little bit of a plug to my son's Chardonnay. He has a fabulous Rain, R-A-E-N.
So I want to talk about that for a second. So Dante and Carlo.
By the way, he said the exact same things I was going to say. That's my answer.
That's your answer?
Yeah, all right,
that
truly,
makes my life easier.
Truly.
So Dante and Carlo make R-A-E-N, Rain. They make Pinot, Chablis. So how long have they been doing it?
2013 was their first year. Carlo wanted to go earlier, but I said, Carlo, listen, we have one opportunity to clarify what we stand for as a family. And so I felt that Robert Mondavi had everything and all the problems were put on his 2 sons. Well, it wasn't quite that way, but we had something to prove with Continuum. And I wanted clear sailing to make sure that what we said, we did it. We said it clearly, we said it consistently, and we said it for a long time. So I held him back. But finally, in 2013, he went out to begin Rain. And it is on the Sonoma Coast. It is a fabulous
Pinot Noir. Did he make his wine at PAX at any point?
Yes, he did.
But is he gone from there? Is he?
No, I think he's still there.
He's still there.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I know there's a bunch of cool people making wine.
Yeah.
I know he was there. It's kind of a nice community.
Yeah. It is.
So that's very nice. Their Pinot and Chard specialist.
That's right.
Right. Now, how does that work within the family? I mean, do you help them? Are they independent? I remember at Skernick, I tasted it there. So I know Continuum is distributed by Skernick. I know Rain is. So I guess it's all the same stuff that way. So that's a good thing. What else can you tell me about that?
Well, I'm very proud of my sons. And
That's good stuff.
It's very good.
It's very good. We've spent an hour and a half talking about attention and perfection in detail. I think that they're doing that too.
They are doing that.
So
and also inspired
dad's
by Burgundy.
Table, so yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a opportunity for them not to move away, but to focus on something. All right. That's the first question. I'm glad we got Ray in because it was here. I said, here, we've got to talk about Dante and Carlo's one. I was hoping maybe to see one of them at the Skernick tasting, but they weren't there. All right. Second question, goofiest question of the bunch. Don't dwell on this again. Favorite wine and food pairing. Not something that you think is a good wine and food pairing, but something you like. Obviously, you don't eat it every week, every month or whatever. But what's that ooh-ah?
Oh, golly, that's harder. Chris, you want to go ahead?
Ooh-ah? You know, the immediate thing that, I mean...
That's all it is immediate.
Sorry, the immediate thing that you, like, every few weeks, whatever, I don't know. I can't say.
Say it!
I mean, comfort food, you know? So, like, a great bowl of pasta and red wine, I'm really into Etna, like having wines
so pasta
from
volcanic, and Sicilian wine.
Yes, volcanic
Sicilian
soils.
Red. Are we talking Nero d'Avola?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Okay,
definitely.
So that's your answer. Yeah. What about you?
Well, I would. I love stews. I love things.
So you like party stuff?
And I like older reds. I like older reds. And,
are we talking Bordeaux, old Napa?
Talking Bordeaux, talking Napa, talking
not
Robert
so much
Mondavi,
Burgundy, right?
Well, but yeah, I also love older Burgundy.
Because a lot of stews
Burgundy
are made with.
Oh, sure. Burgundy. Sure, sure. Buff Bourguignon with Bourguignon.
Right. All right, so you like a nice stew.
And
with...
I'm thinking of a wintertime type of thing. That's, that's when you can relax and really celebrate
sit
a long
by the fire,
night.
Reflect on the
that's
wine.
That's a very traditional answer, but that's a good one. Pull your heads, pull your minds, and answer this one collectively. And it could be around the winery. It could be your travels in the world. And by answering this, by mentioning people, you're not leaving anyone out. But it's just who comes to mind. Favorite wine restaurant and or bar. Where's a place you could walk into where the selection is great, the vibe is cool, the people know their stuff, you feel good about it?
We're talking in our own backyard then.
Anywhere.
Like where we go normally in Napa sort of thing?
Let's start Napa and does anything.
Well, top of mind right now is Marea. We were just there with Francesco Rosso at Marea. Love the Italian seafood. He's got a fabulous selection. And when there, we had a Greek white wine that was absolutely terrific with some of the seafood to begin, and a terrific Rosso from Etna. It was, and the attention to detail that they have, and Francesco is such a consummate professional, and it's the vibe is beautiful.
So by the way, that's the right answer. Incredible wine list. Incredible wine people came out of there. Victoria James, Christo Zazowski, you know, great people have manned the floors. Michael White is no longer there, but his menu lives on.
But everybody there is very welcoming.
It's a
friendly
place.
And
what about in your backyard? Does anything come to mind, or you're too busy and you don't get out?
When we're in our own backyard?
Yeah, up in Napa. Or
what do we want to drink?
Well,
what's a good wine restaurant or bar?
Wine restaurant.
A place.
Bar.
I love, we have our rotation, like the normal places we go. I love Compline, what those guys are doing.
I was going to say that, but I didn't want to leave.
And the food is delicious, always
great
fresh.
Great food, great wine, great vibe,
great
people.
Really great. And then Torque as well. We're huge fans of Torque.
Torque is terrific. Yeah.
All right. Let's stop there. Those are good. All right. Fourth question. We're getting close to the end. Favorite all-time wine? When I initially structured this question 5 years ago, the question was, hey, Tim, you're a baller. You've traveled the world. What's like the most expensive rare wine you've ever tasted?
Expensive
I don't give a crap about that. Because I know you, me, Carissa, we've tasted. What I want to know, and we've talked about historically how wide that swath is. What's the wine to you, and you think about it while he's talking, what's the wine that influenced you the most? What's the wine that was a gateway wine? What was the wine that was a life changer? What's the wine that, you know, awoke you?
I'll have to give maybe three.
And it could be
three.
More than one.
Let me give you three.
Fine.
Three. I would say the older wines of Mouton were incredible.
Okay.
To be able to drink with Baron Philippe and with Lucien and some of these older wines, I absolutely adored that. But I would also say that without any connectivity other than admiration was going into the cellar with Henri Jaillet many years ago and having, I don't remember the year, but I think it was something like the 1980 or one of the best years. And everybody was gaga over his Richebourg, but his Cros Parentus blew it away. Wow, what an incredible wine. And to taste it just
one-on-one.
It's
hard to argue that answer.
In barrel with Henri Jaillet, just one-on-one. And one of the best
He wasn't a whole cluster guy, right?
That's right. He was not.
He was one of the guys.
And so back then, we had been experimenting with whole cluster. And the 83 Robert Mondavi by that time had enough time that it leaned out a little bit. And after seeing Henri Jaillet and tasting that wine, I got away from whole cluster. I finally went back to a little bit of it on a selective basis by block that we did then. And now Carlo uses 100% whole cluster for his wine, having worked at Dujac. But I adored
what's the you said
Hanover
three wines.
Well, Obertivelaine, of
the
course.
Romanys?
Of Romani Cointreau.
So Bertrand, the sun is now jumping in, which is exciting. Right. All right, you?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I wasn't going into my experiences, those extraordinary moments in cellars that I've been really lucky to be in. But then when Dad says that, it spurs all these thoughts in me of when my grandfather brought us through and did this similar sort of trip in Burgundy and Bordeaux and Italy with my generation. But my immediate response, which is what I'm going to stay with, was the for my 21st birthday, Dad, you pulled out some amazing wines from the Rhone Valley. And I actually don't remember what it was. And it's embarrassing to this because I don't know.
Do you remember if it was a Hermitage or a Saint-Joseph?
It was.
No, there are two possibilities. Yeah. One was Chateau Reyes.
Yes, I think it was.
Which I absolutely adore, or Jean-Louis Chave. Yeah. And either of those two.
So the, and maybe both of them, because there was
so
more than one.
So the answer
but
is
like
either or, and I love that, because I'm a big Rhonist, so I'm very impressed.
Yeah, but
You more now.
But the thing was, for me, it was
even
like
more.
The profile was just something so unique and distinctive to me that ever since then, whenever I see those characteristics in a wine, I am immediately smitten, because it's just,
that's
probably the
answer.
Memory.
All right. So I mentioned I post these answers on our social media. Last question, and you should be able to answer this because you got pulled into this. So I asked my guests, recommend to me best wine around $15, $20, $22. My kids are a little younger than you. They're in their late 20s, 30s. They can't show up at dinner parties or give gifts with crappy supermarket wine, but they can't drop 40, 50, 60, believe it or not.
Yeah.
You know, we know how all these white wines are priced. Recommend to me, and you guys have to dig deep on this, recommend to me a red and a white. You can give me category, like Muscadet is a great value for white.
It is.
To me red and white in that price range. Now, when I said it ties into you, ironically, when you went public, you started making wines like Woodbridge and all that, that fell in that price range, that regardless of what your vision was, they were better wines than the other.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So tell me what you think are good wines in that $20 range.
Well, you're kind of leading me to remember when we began producing the white wines of Woodbridge. The idea that I had was this fish wine that I had tasted in the hills of in Switzerland, overlooking Lake Geneva. And I will never forget that there was the fellow from Mövenpick Wines took me around. And we had this lunch with a fish, and the bottle had a fish on it. And I said, "Wow, this was crisp and simple and so easy to drink." I said, "That's exactly what we want for our Woodbridge wines." And we fashioned.
Was that a Swiss wine?
It was a Swiss wine.
Which never leave the country.
From the hills of Lake Geneva.
So that was the inspiration for the style.
Well, it was. It was. And now I would say those that would be more, as we talked about earlier, the Gruner Veltliner.
Gruner's a great white value.
It's terrific. And Muscadet, I love. Muscadet was also important because Muscadet and Muscadet Sourlis, that reinforces the importance of yeast. So Muscadet Sourlis was the higher category of Muscadet.
Right.
So because it was nourished by the yeast, again, that's why we are aging for Continuum, is Sourlis, as they would say there, but it's more Burgundian. It's more... But there are a lot of great wines.
I would say for me, probably Grower Champagne and Cru Beaujolais. But I don't know if
I'm
getting more expensive than I should.
So I'm going to let you get away with Cru Beaujolais. Okay. It may be Village Beaujolais, because Beaujolais has popped
I don't know
up
where the,
in price.
Yeah,
there's no way you get a Grower Champagne into that category.
Anymore. Okay, well,
no.
Let's go.
But people hear the answers and all that. That's how hard the question is to deliver at that price range and all of that.
Etna also.
So Sicily is producing white and red.
White and red. Right. And I think very reasonable
prices.
There's
our answer.
All right. So we're wrapping our show up, and I would like to congratulate the two of you. This is the first ever two-hour Grape Nation episode.
Well, there are two of us.
I
got to
be honest with
Sam.
You. If anyone could sit here and tell me that it lagged and that we could have even spent more time on any topic,
We'd be lying. So, you know, I thank you for sitting here. I don't know where you have to be or whatever, but we're almost there. All right. So we're going to wrap up the show with a segment called our weekly wine sip. So every week we taste a different wine on air.
I'm Chava Perivan, co-host of Agave Road Trip on HRN, here to talk about 818 Tequila. 818 creates their tequila using traditional methods at a family-owned and operated distillery in Jalisco, Mexico. From the blue agave they grow to their recycled glass bottle, 818 emphasizes the earth's importance in all they do. Their distillery runs on biomass and solar power, which means they don't rely as much on fossil fuels and are able to reduce their carbon footprint. Their labels, corks, and boxes are all certified by the Forest Stewardship Council as coming from sustainability-managed forests. 818 is a proud member of 1% for the Planet, through which they support HRN as well as Sacred, my organization in Jalisco, where together we transform agave byproducts and water waste into adobe bricks that are donated to local infrastructure projects, like a local library in Zapotitlán de Vadillo. Visit drink818.com to learn more about their sustainability efforts and find 818 near you. 818 has been part of so many magical nights for me, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
Did you know that over 70% of diners research a restaurant online before ordering from or going in person? Your digital front door is more important than ever. Let Bento Box design and build you a beautifully branded website. Bento Box websites provide sleek design and seamless content management, creating impactful first impressions and converting visitors into customers. And with built-in commerce and marketing tools like online ordering, gift cards, automated email, and more, you can also grow your revenue and keep your diners coming back. Join over 8,000 restaurants that leverage Bento Box to power their digital presence and deliver great hospitality. Visit getbento.com/chef today to get your first month free. That's getbento.com/chef.
So we're going to wrap up the show with a segment called our weekly wine sip. So every week we taste a different wine on air. A lot of times a Somm comes in or whatever, but when you have a winemaker here, why shouldn't the winemaker come in, bring his wine, and we taste it? So I've asked you to provide a wine, and you graciously did, and of course it's your wine. It's the 2019 Continuum, which is your current vineyard in the market. It's grown, what do you call it, Sage Mountain on Pritchard Hill?
Sage Mountain.
Take it from there. And then we're going to evaluate color, palate, taste, all that stuff, all right?
Yeah, so this is the one wine that we make now. Actually, this is everything we're channeling our family history into now. It's incredibly focused. And Dad touched on our setting, but... it really is the culmination of my dad's life's work now to have this incredibly focused wine that we believe is the what best expresses Napa. So this is a unique blend. First of all, the 2019 is really special. It's part of why we're here right now. It's our family's 100th harvest in wine.
Not everyone could sit down and say that.
And you know, and it's our
15th. And as I said earlier, it's why you're in New York.
Yeah,
we have come from wine, and we're still at the very pursuing the very highest level. That's hard to say.
Like a big deal, because you and Auntie Marcy, it's our 15th vintage of Continuum. You guys, with the sale of Robert Mondavi Company, you could have, you know, packed up your bags, found a beautiful island to just enjoy your days on, and instead, you carried on at the same age that Nono had been at 53 years old. You started again.
That's right. Let's not. So your dad, who everyone knows as Napa Wine Royalty, and you, who are very prolific, you and your dad got into their own wineries at the same age, which is crazy. 53. Yes.
Yeah. After working with our families,
you know, people understand working
years.
With the family. Yeah. You know that the going public and all that, but your dad. I mean, it's just a crazy
and
story.
And after the sale of Robert Mondavi Company, my grandfather was still very much alive. And he's like, I don't have a vine to my name. What's the next step? What are we doing? So he was a part of this in the beginning and actually saw the site 1 month before he passed. And just knowing his tremendous will, I think it was seeing that we had our roots back in the soil that allowed him to let go. But anyway, so what we do is truly to honor the generations that came before. This particular blend is 50% Cabernet Sauvignon, 37% Cabernet Franc, 7% Petit Verdot, and 6% Merlot. So it's a very high percentage of Cabernet Franc. In fact, on the label is a Cabernet Franc vine. We're big fans of Cabernet Franc, and it grows fabulously where we are.
Mm-hmm. That's Cabernet Franc? Yes. Isn't that you?
My sister Chiara painted that. She majored in fine art in college.
Yeah.
Worked a lot in the vineyards and the cellar, and actually went back to school to get her degree in viticulture
Franc
and enology.
From your property?
That is, she painted it before we had the property, and so it is a Cabernet Franc vine that I planted in Tokalon, now 30 years ago.
So the question is, we know that you've been involved with Cabernet for so long. This has a lot of Cab Franc in it. What is it about Cab Franc that is so attractive to you?
Oh, I love Cabernet Franc.
Aromatics, body, tell me what it does to your philosophy of making this wine.
Yeah, well, Cabernet Franc is a much more supple, textured wine. There is a high fragrance, violets in the nose, a silky palate. As it ages, it just becomes so expressive.
So aromatics, mouthfeel?
Mouthfeel.
All of that.
Ageability.
Absolutely.
Ageability.
And
ageability.
And
so
it helps with ageability.
It is absolutely terrific. And I think that over time, we are understanding how to improve the quality of our wines, how to make them more complex, more fascinating, more ageable, and also more approachable. I think you see the first growth of Bordeaux becoming much more tender. As we understand each block, every variety better, we can avoid some of the harshness that comes through in the vineyard, by practices in the vineyard, by timing of harvest, by length of skin contact, by, well, many, many different ways of mitigating that, while still also having all the complexity and nuance and fragrance.
But this,
I love this wine, the 19, because I think it is one of the brightest that we have had, yet it also has a richness and the silkiness that does come from the Cabernet Franc and Merlot.
And it's the vibrancy that's coming from the soil, the volcanic soil.
It's incredible for a young wine.
Yeah.
It's so drinkable right now.
And yet you see it has all the tension that will allow it to just get better and better with time.
It's not young, it's not grapey.
I think that the oak fermenters and the concrete fermenters allow, I chose them because I think stainless is fabulous, but it retains more of the youthfulness of the wine, which I love youthfulness. But I don't like youthful mountain tannin. I don't like youthful Cabernet tannin.
No.
I don't
that's
pick
why
up
no
a
stainless.
Lot of...
Well, that's why.
No
it's
yes.
why. Because of oak,
there's
because
no,
of
I mean, I've had duns where, like, this needs 14 more years, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, gone are the days when people would say, oh, wow, what a wine. I can't drink this wine. My son won't be able to drink this wine. My grandson won't be able to drink this wine. But
what good
a
is that?
Wine.
All right. So let's evaluate it. So I'm holding it over a white sheet of paper, very deep, dark, brooding, dark edges, right?
Mm. Very bright, young color. Has
The youngness shows the richness, and the edges are very fresh. All right, let's throw it up to the schnoz, and I suck at this, so what are the nose descriptors that, two things, of this wine, and do a lot of them carry over to the other? This is your 15th vintage, right?
Yes.
For Continuum, that's what I mean. So what's the nose descriptor on this wine? And are those descriptors typical of other vintages?
I think a characteristic that I always get in our wine that's expressive of our site is the savoriness that you get from the native brush sage and bay laurel is influencing these beautiful dried wild herb notes, but it's integrated with where we are. You also have these high tone red fruits that come through. So this, you have that here, but also the deeper dark, blue and black range of fruits
but
are also
the
in
red
there.
Fruit on that
yeah,
too,
but
which
more
makes
high
it,
tone, which is nice, which is what this site gives us.
When we chose this site, we adored it for its undulations for its it has complexity written all over it. And when you see it, it has beauty written all over it. And when you drive around it and you smell the fragrance of the vegetation in the area, it is compelling. It is absolutely beautiful. But you see it reflected in the wine. There is lots of layers.
Is that like the old Heights with the eucalyptus trees? You taste that, would get the savoriness. Not here. But the savoriness of all that sage and brush comes into
I think what you see here is that it is similar in the sense that you get the essence of the vegetation around
The area.
But Heights was also dominated by eucalyptus. And it became so famous early on.
But it was in the wine, right?
People could see it. People could smell it and say, crazy.
Clearly.
And people would say, that's my wine. I recognize it because it was so identifiable.
But
this is more subtle.
Subtle, but you brought up savory, and it's there in a good way.
Yeah.
And whatever the place contributes to it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and the four varieties of grapes, too, right balance and all of that.
So mouthfeel, I want to talk to you about two things. Mouthfeel, I will go first. I think it's a medium plus mouthfeel. I think people drink Napa wines and they're sometimes too unctuous or glycerin-y or cough syrupy. I don't get any of that here, which I love about that. And that leads me to a question. Napa wines were kind of Parkerized. They were big, unctuous, fruity. I mean, did you ever fall prey to that?
No, I don't think we did. In fact, I was criticized for having wines
that had
vibrancy. Robert Parker put me on his heroes list, and then a year or two later...
Heroes because you were doing what he liked, did what you wanted.
I would say then the vintage changed, and also a diversion, and I won't go too much into that because it's a little bit embarrassing, but I would say that he was not a fan of acidity. And so when we had a vintage that retained more acidity, and we were also absent for various reasons, he pounced all over us and mopped the bathroom floor with me. But he couldn't touch my father. He adored my father. And so all of his angst came
on you.
Because we were also doing a lot of other things. And a lot of other things that I was somewhat against doing so many things so
fast. So I think acid is good, and you get your balls broken for having the proper acid.
Then. Now, it is wonderful to see that the wine writers of today, I think, are... I think Parker was also nuanced. I think he had a very, very good palate. But he had a tendency to like bigger wines.
And that's why he loved the Rhone wines.
He loved the Rhone wines, and he loved lower acid wines.
Right.
Another wine.
That has changed.
Antonio
so wait, Maloney, just before you say, wine criticism has become democratized because of online. There are bloggers. There are podcasters.
Yes.
There are, you know... But people who write for the San Francisco Chronicle, nobody knew about them 9 years ago, but now they're available online.
Sure.
So there's a lot more voices. There's a natural wine movement.
Yeah,
there's
absolutely.
Low alcohol, high acidity.
Much more complexity
to your
out there.
Point.
Yes. So there's a lot. And so also the industry is more mature. The industry has grown. America has traveled. It has seen other parts of the world. It is accustomed to higher level of quality of food today, more open to seeing different cuisines, different types of cuisines, and different types of wines. So the need for a single voice telling us what to do is far less. So the role of the critic has altered. It is there to inform it is no longer a single best that is looked for in America. It is a multiplicity of options that people are encouraging.
I agree with that.
So the dynamic is enormously swayed, which evolved, which is a huge, hugely beneficial thing. The quality standard of the wines, the quality standard of the foods, the quality standard of the understanding and the demand on the part of the consumer is worlds beyond what it was when I was a boy.
I agree. There's definitely been a change. All right, let's finish our evaluation. So my question to you is, let's talk about the palate. Does the palate reflect a lot of the descriptors on the nose? Or do you see, that high-tone red fruit, the dark fruits? You know, what do you see? Talk to me about the acidity.
The palate is one of the things I learned from, most important things I learned with Opus. There were many, many, many. But Lucien Cienno taught me as a winemaker that I had relied too much on the sense of smell as a winemaker, because the wines, young wines in the cellar, evolve rapidly. But he said, you really have to look at the palate. You really have to look at that. That is what will tell you what the foundation of the wine. If you have the foundation right, the fragrance will follow.
That's interesting, because a lot of people go the other way.
Well, and I think it is true. As a winemaker, particularly, I think it is, as a consumer, it's less important. But as a winemaker, if all you do is judge on wine, then judge on fragrance, you're missing out its future.
That's a transient quality. You know, that will evolve dramatically, but what stays is more the
But I do think
palette.
That this wine does have a perfume that is quite expressive.
Yes.
I'm very proud of that, and that speaks to its gentle handling.
All right, so answer my question.
And then the palate, on entry, there is a sweetness of entry, a mid-palate that is enduring, and a tannin structure that is strong yet tender. There is a fine quality tannins that are fundamental of importance to me, based on what Lucien told me and taught me working with him years ago, because it does have a through line.
Yes, I think.
What happens to this wine in 10 years? The tannins, which are not a problem.
The tannins, I think, will be in 10 years, the tannins will still, that tension
will still
exist.
They'll still be silky and beautiful.
Even more silky and beautiful and more expressive.
And the fruit will still be.
Absolutely.
Still, even more so.
Yeah.
All right, so last question. We talked about this earlier, but perfect foods to pair this with. If you had that one shot, is it a bloody steak? Is it a burger? Is it red sauce?
Another anecdote from Philippe Cotin from our days when wine and food dynamics were in the air everywhere and umami was talked about and how you had to eat this and how you couldn't have that. And how
there was a chain called Umami Burger.
And so Philippe Cotin's response is, we were giving birth to Opus at the time. He said, you know, Tim, in Bordeaux, we think there are two rules about wine and food. First, it must be red. And second, it must go with everything.
That's fair. Salmon.
Yeah, if the wine is...
wine doesn't go with salmon, right?
If the wine is balanced.
Does.
And we had great chefs. The great chefs. Last night we were with Danielle.
Yeah.
What amazing man. Oh, my God. He was so wonderful and spent a lot of time with us and said the nicest of things. And anyway, but we've had a lot of these great chefs that would come through, and they would cook fish with red wine, and they would be incredible. Alain Sandorens was that way. There were so many people. But the wine must be balanced.
So the answer, like, other than asparagus or artichokes, this goes with anything.
Or oysters.
This goes with any. Right. Oysters are the best. That's where you grow champagne.
Yeah.
But pretty much, you know, be prepared to drink with it. And I believe in that, you know, there's no wine, you know, tradition or anything. Drink the wine you like with the food you like.
Absolutely.
You know, period.
Yeah. My father used to have all kinds of rules about what we could do and what we couldn't do. But towards the end of his life, he said there are two rules, a little bit like Philippe Cotin. Drink what you like what you drink.
I agree with that. All right, we got to wrap up the show. I thank both of you guys for this marathon session. And Carissa, I don't think you figured on being here as long as we were going to be.
This is wonderful.
Listen,
thank you.
Everything flows, so
absolutely.
It's hard for me to, you know.
I've been wanting Dad to write a book, and this just proves that, you know.
Well, yes. And I'd like to comment on something, that it's a beautiful thing to sit here with you, Tim, and with you, Carissa. I've done a lot of shows on generational change and, you know, what new generations are bringing in. And
you know, this project is a great project, and I know that you're heavily involved. But the thing that impresses me the most, sitting here with the two of you, how the two of you look at each other. You know, the way you look at your dad, and I know you think I'm crazy. It's like, you know, F this guy, I'm out of here. You look at him with such reverence. And when we started the interview, you said, you know, Carissa and I are going to talk and all of that. So I just the connection between you is so beautiful. And I think that that translates into Continuum and the project and the multi-generational thing. And that to me is, you know, more of a charge, you know, than anything else, the history.
For me as well.
So I thank you guys. Let me do quick wrap up. And I want to get some info from you. So if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. The reason we ask you to subscribe is when you subscribe, you wake up and you get up and there's Tim and Carissa with this way too long interview that has too much stuff to absorb, but by subscribing, you get everything sent to you. You can follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation, on Instagram, we're at SBenRuby, on Twitter, we're at BenRuby. We know that's a little confusing, but you can always reach us at the hashtag The Grape Nation. As I mentioned, we'll post Tim and Carissa's wine list answers, because there's some cool stuff there, and I will post the weekly wine sip selection. You know, I'll mention vintage, you know, some of the things we talked about, because that's the current Continuum wine. And this is a winery that makes, you know, only a handful of wines. Now, I got to get out of here, but there's a second wine, Novissium.
Novissium,
yes.
Yeah. And that, explain what that is. Well, you will not. What was that expression? No, never mind. But you won't put younger vines into, but old, you will make a wine.
Vines, wines, and people have a lot in common. The good get better with time.
Right.
Old vines make great wine, but you have to get there.
Right.
And so what do you do with the young vines? And that's what Novissium is all about. So everything we have is grown, produced, and bottled within our own estate. And so Novissium is basically there for the younger vines. And I am so delighted with it because it is showing the strength of this site and also the care that
even
it received.
Even at a young vine age.
Even at
Do you
young
sell
vine
any
age,
of the?
Well, a lot of people. Well, we are beginning to release it out into the world. It's only been on a direct basis recently, but we are beginning to open it up out in the world.
And careful, long-term view first. Make sure people understand.
Yes,
continue.
I move
a
so slow.
There, okay.
I move a so slow.
You sound like Cesare.
Yes, yes. But
that's Novissium. So listen, I'm going to say something, and you may snark at me a little, but these are luxury wines. The price point is on the higher end. Mm. But when you hear about what goes into these wines, the plot, you know, the effort into it, you understand why. As far as price, I mean, we're not talking crazy prices. I mean, there's Bordeaux and even Napa wines that are exponentially.
I apologize to other neighbors on Pritchard Hill because we are way lower than they.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. So I just want people to understand. I mean, this is a luxury wine. This is a family wine. This is a wine of history. This is a generational wine. So realize that. If we want to get more information, if somebody said, Jesus, I sat here for 2 hours and 22 minutes, how do I get more information? What's the best place to go to the website?
Yeah, absolutely. www.continuumestate.com.
Two U's. C-O-N-T-I-N-U-U-M.
C-O-N-T-I-N-U-U-M-E-S-T-A-T-E.com.
And there's a mailing list. I don't know if it's open or not, but you can go on and you can do that. It's in restaurants.
Sure.
It's in some retail and all that. If we want to follow you guys on social media, do you pay any attention to that?
Not enough.
What about you?
More
Carissa, what about you on Instagram?
currently, I deleted it from my phone the last few months. But I should re-engage. I love Instagram.
We do, but we don't. We are not as we're under a bit under a rock or under a barrel.
So the wines sell themselves, and the name sells itself. But you guys, I'm telling you, you guys need to get a little more involved into social media. I would start with Instagram.
We're very old school. We are very old school. We travel into the market in person to sell each
There's
bottle
nothing
in
wrong
person.
With that. I mean, yeah. we're from the same generation, but you need to get on there.
I know.
All right. So I want to thank our guests, Tim Mondavi, Tim and his daughter, Carissa Mondavi, from Continuum Wines. I want to thank our engineers, Matt and Kevin, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.